Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. What's the most powerful force in America? Entertainment, says our guest Neil Gabler. This highly respected cultural observer says entertainment is everything. He wrote a biography of Walt Disney because Disney's the colossus of American popular culture, Mr. Gabler says. Understand Walt Disney and you understand America. Mr. Gabler's no Pollyanna. In addition to feisty animations and furry dancing creatures, he also considers Disney's dark side, a lifelong obsession to control the audience. Before his death, Disney had a troubling real-life community on the drawing boards. He called it Epcot.
Interesting thing about Walt Disney, a case of arrested development, but Walt Disney really, because of Roy Disney, was able to live within his imagination in a way that almost no one else in American business is able to do. At the end of his life, after he's dead, one of his collaborators goes to Roy, Walt's brother, and says, we've really got to build Epcot as a memorial to Walt. This is what everything was headed toward in Walt's life. And Roy said, Walt's dead.
Neil Gabler's works address the heart and soul of American popular culture. He's the first biographer to have full access to Disney's archives in writing Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Other critically acclaimed books Mr. Gabler's written include Winchell, Gossip, Power, and The Culture of Celebrity, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, and Life, the Movie. Mr. Gabler is a senior fellow at the Norman Lear Center for the Study of Entertainment and Society at the University of Southern California. Bill Russell and I share Mr. Gabler's fascination with popular culture, and we were sure we were about to enjoy a very entertaining conversation. Neil Gabler, as I was reading Walt Disney, I try real hard to, as I read, to look away as well as to look back, because I do a lot of reading, and so my keep the eyes, muscles from just atrophying. So I kept looking away and then back to Walt Disney, and you had many pages that I could enjoy. And my eye kept catching an image that we have in the living room where I usually read that is the very famous Picasso of the young woman in the mirror, which is credited with being sort of the first time in Western culture that we begin to really see the subconscious, that Picasso really brought the subconscious during a time when Freud was starting to kick in and stuff. Well, I kept thinking as I read Walt Disney, Neil Gabler is telling me about the subconscious of this country in ways that I don't think most of us think about. Did that lead you to this monumental work on
Absolutely.
Walt Disney? Absolutely.
First of all, let me say something about Picasso and Disney, if I may, because I've said in other contexts, you know, the two great visual imaginations of the 20th century, in my estimation, were Picasso and Walt Disney. And you can trace almost all of 20th century art from these two traditions, if one wants to call them that. Obviously, Picasso creating a whole large thrust of American and world art, and Walt Disney being really the kind of progenitor of pop art. And yet, there are hundreds of books on Picasso, and there are very few biographies of Walt Disney, and no fully annotated, full-scale biography of Walt Disney until I wrote my book.
Well,
I count for it in two ways. One is that the Walt Disney Studio was very loath to give anyone access, and I was very fortunate to gain access to the studio. So that's, I think, one impediment. But the other is, and this tells us something about American culture generally, I think that most serious biographers were loath to deal with a subject like Walt Disney. Walt Disney is a figure of the popular culture. You cannot win a Pulitzer Prize writing a biography of a figure of the popular culture. There has never been a Pulitzer awarded.
Is that right?
Yes. I mean, you write about artists, fine artists. You write about statesmen. You write about civil rights leaders. You write about presidents. But you can't write about a Walt Disney and expect to win the big prizes. So I think that most serious biographers steer themselves away from dealing with subjects like Walt Disney. Now, that's a long detour from the question you asked.
No, not at all.
But the question you asked to me is relevant to what I just said, because I have taken it sort of as my own personal mission this sounds self-aggrandizing, but nevertheless, to deal with those figures.
If you don't self-aggrandize, who will?
Yes, well, that's true.
To deal
with those figures who are architects of the American consciousness, those people who shape the way we think about the world.
And those the way the world thinks
about us. Oh, exactly. I mean, it's certainly reciprocal. And those figures are more likely than not to be figures of the popular culture. So my first book, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, is the story of that first generation of Hollywood moguls. And in understanding that story, the men who created Hollywood, we understand a great deal about ourselves. You know, the irony of that book is, and I say this in the introduction of that book, you know, here are a group of Eastern European Jewish immigrants who come to the United States and create an America out of their own imaginations, which then comes to define America for everyone.
And it's not even close.
No. I mean, everyone thinks of America in terms of Hollywood and Hollywood images and Hollywood values and Hollywood characters.
You know, it's interesting you say that because that's more or less exactly what Hugh Masekela said when he came to this country. Mm-hmm. He said, jazz, the music he was playing, we saw America as the homeland.
Mm-hmm. Out of South Africa.
Yes. You know, as a kid growing up in South Africa, and you know where this all started. But he came to this country because this was the homeland. Mm. And I think you know what you're doing with popular culture, like everything else, we tend to be stupid about it. And if we don't understand these roots and how challenged in some ways these roots are, and how tortured in some ways the process of getting, and now the metaphors are trashed. But if we don't understand that, we don't understand ourselves.
Exactly.
We don't understand where we live.
That's what I want to do. And my book on Walter Winchell was, you know, looking at the roots of modern American journalism and our obsession with celebrity. And my third book, which is called Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality, is a kind of book-length essay to examine the forces that I regard as the most significant forces in American culture in the 20th century, which is the force of entertainment, and the way in which entertainment changes everything. The single most powerful force, more powerful than politics or religion.
Absolutely.
Or economics, you know, entertainment is that thing that converts everything from politics to religion to education to you name it. And of course, in dealing with Walt Disney, I'm dealing with maybe the man who was the colossus of American popular culture. So understand him, understand us. That's the way I look at it.
This is Neil Gabler, and he's qualified to say these things. It is our great pleasure to have Neil Gabler with us here on The Paula Gordon Show. We trust you'll be with us when I, Paula, Bill Russell, and Neil Gabler return. We're delighted to be with Neil Gabler here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell gave you the opportunity to talk about Colossus with Walt Disney. America being a colossus in the world, sometimes a bully, sometimes a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Makes the Walt Disney story a lot bigger than just, you say, oh, I write about America. Uh-uh. When you write about Walt Disney, you're talking about certainly the industrialized world, but in a very keen sense, you just can't go much of the world without knowing that those ears that belong to Mickey Mouse mean something.
Well, he's an American figure. There's no question about that. You know, there was an earlier biography by Bob Thomas, a popular biography, called Walt Disney, an American Original. And I kind of take exception to that in my own book by saying, no, he really wasn't an American original. He was a quintessential American. He was a kind of an American everyman. You know, if you look at his life, there's a kind of novelistic pattern to it. He's born at the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th and the 20th century. He's born in the Midwest. You know, he migrates the American heartland. He grows up on a farm because his family moves from Chicago, urban Chicago, to this farm in Marceline, Missouri. He migrates to California. I mean, in some ways, that's the archetypal American story.
And his father moves the family to a farm because he's very suspicious of cities.
Exactly.
And that's very much part of the American tension between the city and the country.
Oh, yes. I mean, he looks at the values of the rural community and says, I want to raise my family in these values. And Walt Disney, you know, kind of imbibes those values. And indeed, that five-year period that he spent on that farm in Marceline becomes the touchstone of almost his entire life. And in some ways, one could say, without being too heavily psychological about it, that Walt Disney spends the rest of his life trying to find his way back to that Tom Sawyerish existence that he had in Marceline, Missouri. But having said all of that, as you said, Paula, nevertheless, Walt Disney resonates with everyone. And I think he resonates with everyone because the subtext of all of Walt Disney's work, whether it's the animations or the theme parks, is the notion of control and perfectionism. Walt Disney is an obsessive perfectionist. He is a man who wants to control the world. He lived, despite what I just said about that halcyon period at Marceline, Missouri, what he regarded as a somewhat Dickensian existence, because they move from that farm in Marceline, the Disney family, to Kansas City. They're back in that urban environment. And Walt is forced to deliver papers, newspapers, for his father's newspaper route. His father owned a newspaper. That was his father's job in Kansas City, and it's every bit as demeaning as it sounds. And Walt would wake up 40 years later in a cold sweat, in the middle of the night, having nightmares about, oh, I forgot to deliver that newspaper. My dad is going to beat me.
And his dad had.
You know, the first line of my book is Elias Disney, Walt Disney's father. Elias Disney was a hard man. Truer words were never said. He was a hard man. And Walt grew up in this hardness so that he was always looking for a way to create his own world, a world that was controlled by him, not by Elias Disney, a world in which he could immerse himself imaginatively. Now, that notion of control, in my estimation, you know, resonates clearly with Americans who live in this whole kind of perfectionist bubble. We were the city on the hill, early on in our existence.
And we had delusional bubbles?
Yes, oh, of course.
just checking.
And Walt Disney played to that. But the rest of the world also plugs into the notion that the world will bend to our will. And I think people vicariously got that sense in Walt Disney's animations and in his theme parks that the world would bend to Walt Disney's will, and therefore it may bend to ours as well. When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. Boy, is that not a resonant theme?
And we can all sing it.
That's right.
You know, talking about his growing up, which is obviously mm-hmm. central in this, one of the things that I came away from this with, which was in Disney, in some ways, is a tribute to what one can do without an education.
Oh, yes.
He's also an object lesson in what the limits that you run into mm-hmm. without having that education, because in many ways, the appearance to me is that a lot of the frustrations and his inability to, in many ways, to empathize. I mean, he's very good at reading the popular culture. He was much less good at working with the people around him.
Oh, yes.
But I think a lot of that was just an absolute failure of education because he simply didn't have the intellectual predicates, the experience, the tool set, to be able to see that his idea of perfection was not necessarily universal.
But, of course, one could look at it the other way and say that Walt Disney would have accomplished nothing if he didn't have those blinders on. You know, Walt Disney was a man, unlike most people of his generation and of his stature, who did not have education. And again, I think back to the first generation of Hollywood moguls. Most of them had a certain sense of deprivation and a sense of inferiority, that they hadn't been educated. Walt Disney, interestingly, never suffered a sense of inferiority. I mean, this man was absolutely self-confident, had total belief in his mission and in his vision.
And his mission and his vision were
creating a perfect world. Now, that perfection manifested itself in different ways. I mean, early on, it was the Mickey Mouse cartoons. But when Walt was making those Mickey Mouse cartoons, he very quickly tried to elevate them from the contemporary cartoons of the time by inserting things like what we call secondary effects, seeing what happens to the hair on a character when a character moves, or seeing the way that the wind reacts to clothing, or seeing the way that the mass reacts to gravity. These are things that no animator ever cared about. You know, the mouth moved, and if somebody ran, the legs moved. But nothing else moved. Walt Disney was interested in creating a sense of realism as a means of creating a more fully realized world.
Yeah, but it was realism with tongue-in-cheek. It was realism, but it wasn't real.
Well, that's right. He called it a caricature of reality. He understood that it wasn't photographic reality. So it was a caricature of reality. But nevertheless, it was Walt's way of dominating the world, again, of bending the world to his will. Now, a more educated man might not have had the kind of perseverance or the bullying element that he had, because you said, you know, he didn't work well with his employees, and he didn't, because he didn't see them as collaborators. Walt was not a collaborative man. Walt saw them as facilitators. You know, the animators were not artists in their own right, in Walt's estimation, though in most of our estimations they were, but Walt saw them as people who would facilitate what was in his head. You know, there's a great story about Snow White, that Walt would tell the story of Snow White repeatedly, again and again and again, sort of like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. You know, I mean, he just never would let go of that story. Animators would see him walking down the hall and they'd turn the other way because they didn't want to be collared and hear the story of Snow White again. And yet the reason he did that, in my estimation, was that he was running that story through the projector of his head and making all the kinds of corrections and edits in that story that he would then give to his animators, which is why he told it repeatedly, so that they would understand what was in Walt Disney's head and they could get it on the screen.
Because he couldn't explain it.
No, he couldn't. He could tell it, but he couldn't explain it.
He could act it, too.
He could act it. He was, you know, when Walt Disney left for California, he said, there are two career options for me. I could be an artist or I could be an actor. And Walt never really left the idea of being an actor. He was a consummate performer. And if you see, and I have seen, there's one snippet of film of Walt Disney voicing Mickey Mouse. Now, a lot of people don't know that Walt Disney was that falsetto voice of Mickey Mouse until 1946. But there's this snippet of film, and Walt was very self-conscious about it. That's why there's only a snippet of Walt voicing Mickey, and he doesn't just voice Mickey. He becomes Mickey Mouse. I mean, you see him, his body language, the way he tilts his head, you know, all of it is the very personification of Mickey Mouse, not just Mickey's voice.
You have a line in there on that subject that I just looked up. The eternal promise of cheerful solipsism.
Yes.
Which is precisely, to me, you know, you use it with respect to Mickey Mouse. But it really is a description in many ways of Walt Disney.
It certainly is. You know, Walt identified very closely with Mickey Mouse. It's one of the reasons he voiced him. He tried other voices and no one satisfied him, so finally he said, I'm going to do the voice. But there is no question Mickey Mouse was Walt Disney's alter ego. And if Mickey Mouse is, you know, the embodiment of cheerful solipsism, so is Walt Disney. Walt Disney lived within his own world, within his own head. Even when it came to his family, and he was a very doting father to his two daughters, but even so, the family was not the top priority. The top priority was always the studio. And if you go to Walt Disney's office, even today, and it's barren now, but if you go down that hallway in the animation building at the Burbank studio, there is his office, but then there's an anteroom, and it's got a bed, and it's got a shower, because Walt Disney literally lived at the studio for much of the time. And if you go to Disneyland, many people know that above the firehouse at Disneyland, there is an apartment. Also, it has been preserved, where Walt Disney would live when he visited Disneyland. His life was dedicated to his studio and then to his theme park. His entire life was dedicated to purveying his vision of the world.
Neil Gabler has written Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Bill Russell will have a chance to continue as I lead us out of this segment, and we come back in just a moment with more of the Paula Gordon Show. Be with us, please. It is our great pleasure to be with Neil Gabler, whose many books now include Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination, Walt Disney being that triumph, maybe, Bill Russell.
I hadn't really thought of this. You're talking about Snow White, and he does this all the way through, that he keeps working it and working it and working it, trying to make it perfect. One of the problems with, I would assume a biographer has this challenge. We were talking about it before we started. Certainly movie making has it. The problem is there is no easy encoding system. You know, 3x5 cards are you know, a tool, but it's not. And ultimately, one way or another, it ends up inside your head.
Oh, yes.
My experience is as a film editor or a video editor. And at some point, you know, you have all your notes out there, but at some point, the whole thing has to come together in your head.
Oh, that is so true.
And the alternative, of course, is to get it out there. But once you get it out there, so you can collaborate, it loses something. It becomes a corporate undertaking rather than an individual. And not to say one is better than the other, but there is sort of a pristine purity to that single vision. There's also an obsessive compulsive portion of that.
There's no question. I mean, anyone who does this kind of work has to be obsessive compulsive. And I actually wrote a piece for the Washington Post Book World last November that I called Method Biography.
Mm.
And the idea was that every biographer is a method actor. Mm-hmm. More than anything else, more even than a detective or psychologist or archaeologist or whatever, every biographer, if he's any good at this job, is a method actor. Because you have to internalize that life. You have to take all of those note cards and you've got to somehow internalize them, forge a life out of them. And you've got to find the correspondences in your own life to the life of your subject, or the book won't have any life to it. Biography is a tactile business. It's tactile in the writing of it. When you hold in your hand those documents, you know, I held in my hand the letters that Walt Disney is writing, the original letters that he's writing from New York to his brother Roy and his wife Lillian in Los Angeles when he's trying to sell Mickey Mouse because he doesn't have a distributor. He's made these films on what we call spec, on speculation, that he's going to sell them. And you hold in your hand those letters, written sometimes two and three a day, and you're flipping through them, and Walt Disney, you know, enters your fingers and your body through those letters. But he also enters your consciousness. And you become, in effect, Walt Disney. Again, if you're any good at this. And I spent 7 years on this book, so I can say with all honesty that I lived with Walt Disney in my head for 7 years.
The way that he lived with his films in
exactly,
his head.
Exactly. And you know, one of the other comments I make in Method Biography is that the writing of the book replicates the life of the subject. And what you said, Paul, is exactly true. I mean, I had to be obsessive compulsive when I was writing the book in the way that Walt was. Walt was under tremendous financial strains, which may surprise a lot of our listeners, that Walt Disney was under tremendous financial pressures after Snow White through the opening of Disneyland. He was almost always on the ropes financially and was on the verge of bankruptcy many, many times. Well, I'll tell you, writing this book, I was often on the financial ropes, frankly. And when I was writing about Walt's urgency, you know, I was writing about my own urgency as well. Now, that may be revealing too much, but I think it gives the book a sense, again, of the tactile. And here's another thing. I researched the book. I researched the book, and I research all my books in chronological order. And I'll tell you why I do that. Now, that may seem like you know, logical thing to do, but not all biographers do it. I do it because we all know that Walt Disney is going to be successful. But Walt Disney didn't know.
Right.
So when you write in the moment, when you stay in the moment with your subject, you have a sense of suspense as well as honesty that you don't have if you write as if you know the story. I try and forget the ending of the story, frankly, as I'm writing.
I'm told that Barbara Tuchman says that about anybody who is writing about history, that you have to not know how it's going to come
That's
out.
That's right.
This is a curious variant on that famous line, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
That is so true of biography.
And it's interesting in this context, and you're saying it so forcefully brings it. This will sound harsh, like a criticism, but it's not. There's an incoherence to this book.
In the most positive sense.
I hope so.
Yes.
That recapitulates Disney. I mean, you know, you talk about perfection, and I think most of us have a platonic sense of perfection. Mm-hmm. which is to say it is there, it's fixed forever and ever. Right. And I think people, we have that same idea about people, particularly mm-hmm. historical people. And in a lot of it's the way we're taught history. You know, this is the cartoon version.
Exactly.
And this is how people really are. Well, they're not. And no. Disney never did. I mean, there were parts of him, there were parts of him, I think, that never talked to one another.
Oh, I think you're he was a very compartmentalized man and not a very introspective man, which is a difficult thing for a biographer. You know, it's wonderful to have someone who introspects, which is why, frankly, you know, I'm going to tip my hand here, it's so much easier to write about literary figures who are much more introspective than to write about someone like Walt Disney who is not introspective at all. So,
and if he were, he wouldn't tell you.
Exactly, yes. So, you know, you're right. He's a very compartmentalized man. People with whom he dealt saw different sides of him, different facets of him, but no one ever saw the man whole.
Did he ever see himself whole?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. You know, I think Walt Disney saw himself as a man on a mission. And he was determined he was going to fulfill that mission. And it turned out to be a series of missions because Walt was an odd fellow in this sense as well. He operated on what I call renunciation. By which I mean that when he realized something was not going to be as good as it had been, and I'll give an example right here, the animations. He comes to a realization in the mid-1940s that he's never going to make an animation that was as good as Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, and Bambi because he doesn't have the financial resources, frankly, to do so anymore. Then he renounces animation. He says, if I can't make another great animation, I don't want to make any animations. Now, of course, the studio makes animations. They go on and make Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan and Lady and the Tramp and 101 Dalmatians. But Walt Disney has surprisingly little to do with any of those films. He moves on to the theme park. And then when he achieves what he wants to achieve at the theme park, he renounces that and moves on to something else, which turns out to be Epcot, not as we know it, but as Walt Disney visualized it, which is a fully operational city of the future. So Walt operated in a series of renunciations.
He also insisted that this wasn't about money, and it was about money. And blessedly, he had Roy, his
That's
brother.
That's right.
That made it possible. He, you know, it allowed him to focus, but it, you know, as he gets older, you know, for all he's still saying this isn't about money, he becomes extremely, excruciatingly acquisitive.
I found myself angry with him that he was, by golly, going to do what he was going to do, and Roy would be the one who would
clean it up.
Yeah, and maybe there are reasons I was, but it wasn't fair.
No, and it's an absolutely accurate depiction, I think, in your responses is a certainly understandable one. Walt was going to do what he was going to do no matter what. If it bankrupted the company, it didn't make any difference. And he made those animations, those golden animations, at a tremendous loss. He made the shorts for a long period of time at a loss. He wasn't making profit on those things, and he didn't care. And he would say to his brother Roy, 8 years older than he, the chief financial officer of the company, as most people know, and he would say to Roy, look, it's your job to get the money. It's my job to come up with the ideas. It's your job to get the money. He was very disdainful of Roy because Roy wasn't a creative person. On the other hand, Roy was very protective of Walt, ran interference for Walt. And, you know, as you said, Bill, I mean, this company could not have survived. And Walt wouldn't have survived had it not been for Roy Disney. He would have been thrown out of the company many years earlier because he was determined to do what he was going to do.
Well, what's the difference between being a spoiled brat and being a genius?
Well, they always say money is the difference between being a lunatic and being a genius. And in a certain extent, that's true for Walt Disney because he did have Roy there to provide the money for himself. And Walt was a visionary. I mean, let's not stint him on that. I think it's fair to say that Walt was the visionary force of that studio. Walt created those animations full-blown out of his head. As I said earlier, you know, that projector was always running in his head, and those animations were his.
And they were darn near perfect.
They were. I mean, not Walt's eyes, because the problem with being a perfectionist is that you're always condemned to live within the failings of your own abilities. They can never attain perfection. Walt always lived within the nimbus of disappointment because nothing was ever as good as he wanted it to be.
He was also, part of what was interesting is he wasn't just creative. He was also had a remarkable faculty for the mechanical.
Yes,
and,
he did.
And the visual, and in some ways that was, you know, another part of this character is his, you know, his, he was a tinkerer.
He certainly was a tinkerer, and of course that's why he got into animation. You know, animation combined the two halves of Walt Disney, so to speak. I mean, the artistic and the mechanical. It was perfect for him.
And then there was the Dickens part of it that he would be able to express. We'll come back in just a moment with Neil Gabler. A lot more about Walt Disney, a lot more about the other half of that title, which is the triumph of the American imagination. Be with us when we return. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Neil Gabler certainly qualifies as a person at the leading edge. And there's sort of a stereopticon going on here. How'd I do? Can we say that? I just did. Isn't it Bob Dylan who said, "I said it, so it must be true"? Neil Gabler as the culture critic observer, and Walt Disney as so very important to the American culture and that which then gets exported. Bill Russell?
Well, in that same context, you know, there's the tinkerer and the animator. And then somewhere, it's almost as if it comes out of the blue, it turns out what he really wanted to do was produce live-action movies.
That's correct.
And I said, where did that come from? And I think part of it, of course, is the, you know, realizing that he couldn't perfect, you know, the economics at least, and ultimately he couldn't, nothing's perfect. But I said, what happened that all of a sudden this guy who is the, you know, literally the avatar of animation in the world, really wanted to make live-action movies?
Yes, he did. Of course, I think one of the reasons is because he loved the idea of photographic reality and creating, again, his own world on screen. And one of the things he admired about live-action movies is the range of emotion that they could elicit. And when he starts making Snow White, that is really the kind of engine of Snow White. Can we elicit the same range of emotions from animated characters that one can get from live-action characters?
As you say, drawings. Can drawings make people cry?
That's right. That is the question. In fact, you know, not too many years earlier, the animators are sitting around and they're questioning, will people accept a voice emanating from drawings? So this is how far we've come by the time he releases Snow White in December 1937. Not only are people accepting a voice coming from a drawing, because after all, the reason that question was asked is, you know, we know that people talk, but do drawings talk? But now in December 1937... when he releases Snow White, the moment of testing is when the dwarves are surrounding the bier of Snow White.
The bier being the platform on which her presumed to be dead body.
Yes,
is
exactly.
Laying.
We're not talking about the beverage.
No, we're talking B-I-E-R, and the audience has got to at that moment, if the film is going to be successful, cry along with the dwarves. Or at least along with Grumpy, because Walt had ordained that only Grumpy would have a tear. He said that will really get him. He knew how powerful that would be, that the most stubborn and ornery of the dwarves is the one whose eyes missed up. And of course, at the premiere, that gala premiere, the audience just breaks down, and Walt and the animators, who are all in attendance, know they've got them. They've
and
done
that's
something.
Clark Gable and Carol Lombard and the
yes.
great actors.
Cecil B. DeMille and, yeah. you know, the whole...
The great performers of the day.
That's right. Were there and they were responding to animated drawings, crying at animated drawings. So Walt had ultimately achieved what he wanted to achieve. It would have been easier to do so with live action film. And of course, he later goes into live action film partly out of necessity because... He started the live-action films in England because England, after the war, had withheld the profits that Walt had made in England and compelled those profits to be spent in England. So Walt had the choice of either opening an animation studio in England, which he wasn't about to do, or making live-action films in England with those profits, which is what he did do, and that led him ultimately to make live-action films even in the United States.
There's this
and they were
parallel.
Good movies.
Yes, they were good movies. Well done. And films that... created another kind of cottage industry for Walt Disney, which was the Boyhood Adventure.
There's the parallel universe, to You know, the Disney, the artist, is the is the real world.
Yes.
One of the reasons they didn't open an animation studio, they were having a terrible time making money doing animations because it was so bloody expensive, because he wanted to do the things he wanted to do.
And he wouldn't cut corners.
And he wouldn't cut corners. In addition to the economics of this, which is a big piece of the, in some ways, the drama, the ongoing drama, there are a couple other things that seem to be pivotal. One, the Depression, he didn't notice the Depression.
That would be the Great Depression.
He was actually, you know, and doing probably better than, actually better before than and after.
That's absolutely true. So Depression was good for Walt Disney. Yeah. The post-war period, which was good for everybody else, wasn't so good for Walt Disney.
And, of course, the other, you know, as much later, is the labor problems that,
yes.
that came up.
And
that
I don't think
he inflicted on himself.
Well, I don't think they're unrelated. I mean, the real world and his fantasy world, in many ways, he did not have full contact with the real world. That was Roy's job.
Right.
And he had missed the most salient, one of the most salient events of the 20th century, at least in this country and in Western Europe. Which was the Great Depression.
Well, for all intents and purposes, he misses the war as well. I tell the story in the book where he's designing the studio, the new studio in Burbank that he built with the profits from Snow White. And it's early – it's sometime in 1940, so the Americans have not entered the war yet. And Walt is playing with a model, and one of his animators asks, but, you know, how is the war going to affect this? And Walt says, what war? Walt was oblivious because he did live within his own world. But I think, you know – one of the things you said, Bill, that the real world and the fantasy world collide for Walt Disney, particularly with the strike in 1941. Because when Walt builds this new studio in Burbank, which he intends to be a worker's paradise, it will have every amenity possible. It will have, if you're an animator and you want to have a malted milk delivered to your animation table, you press a button and there will be a malted milk delivered to your animation table. If you want to go to a sauna bath and work out in a gym, there is a gym and a sauna on the top of the animation building. I mean, there was nothing that Walt overlooked. The slats in the awnings that could be adjusted for the light for the animators. Tunnels under the studio so that if it rained, they could still transport the drawings to the camera department to be photographed. There was nothing that he overlooked. But in the process
except.
Of creating, except human emotion. And what happened when he built that perfect studio is that he became increasingly distant from his employees. In building the animation building, Walt had even stratified the animation building so that his office and the story department was on the top floor, and then there would be a flow. This is how logically he had thought about it and routinized it. There would be a flow to the next floor where the layout artists and the background artists would work, and then there would be a flow to the animators on the first floor, and the camera was in the basement. So the work would flow down. But you see as well how he stratified everything. And in creating that stratification and in distancing himself on the third floor from the animators with whom he'd worked so closely, who are now on the first floor, Walt was creating the tensions and the rifts within his own company. And then when you add on top of that his paternalism, his hogging credit, and finally his refusal to accept the recognition of a union because he could not understand, having created this workers' paradise, why anyone would need a union. All of these things created the incipient situation for a strike to occur, and it did in May of 1941.
He was also a lousy manager.
And terrible
that,
manager.
And in that context, and he, not only was he a lousy manager, but he wouldn't let anybody else manage.
Well, that's why he was a lousy manager in a way.
Right. But when you throw that into this mix, and you have to in the way you sympathize with him, he thought he had created, and it's not by accident, this is a worker's paradise.
Exactly.
Straight out of Marxism.
Right.
Which he abhorred.
Sort of.
Later, after the strike. But before, he actually made the comment, apropos of what Bill is saying, where he said, this is like Jesus Christ communism, he said, looking at the studio. Now, what he didn't insert into that is that he was the Jesus Christ. And that was the resentment. You know, I say in the book that the studio did not operate like any other studio. It operated as if it were a cult. And Walt Disney was the Jim Jones of that cult. And until the strike, it did function as a cult. But after the strike, Walt lost his status as the cult figure.
In a very interesting way, it appeared to me as this moved through that what he had done was to give away the joys of creativity and turned it into a factory.
It did, but I'll tell you, it happened, I think, against Walt's resistance. There's a very interesting point in the history of the studio where the studio exists to make animations, obviously, and then the animations exist so that the studio can be maintained. When the studio crosses over, Walt is helpless. He is the prisoner of the studio, the prisoner of the scale of the operation.
All of which bears his name.
All of which bears his name. And Walt, when he makes Disneyland, when he begins to create Disneyland, what does he do? He creates a very small entity, a kind of boutique within the studio, Wed Enterprises, in an attempt to get back to the way it used to be in the early days before the studio was big, because Walt hated corporatism. He hated that scale. He wanted something small and intimate, and he was always searching for it. But of course, nothing succeeds like success, and nothing exceeds like excess, as they say in Scarface. So here he was creating a very successful enterprise that ultimately doomed the things that Walt loved about the enterprise.
We're going to be back in a moment, so I don't have to interrupt the next thing I want to talk about with Neil Gabler, who has written Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Mr. Gabler, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, invite you to return in a moment. We're back with Neil Gabler here on The Paula Gordon Show, also known as The Walt Disney Show at the moment. When I mentioned to a friend that we were going to be doing a program with you today, she said, Neil Gabler, which reminded me how important what you are doing is, that you are known in and of yourself, quite apart from Walt Disney. And then as I listened to you say that you internalized Walt Disney, you are known for talking about the Disneyfication of America. And yes. Richard Schickel did a pretty good job helping us think about that as well.
From a different perspective.
Indeed. Having taken on that persona in the course of writing this biography, I find a great deal that is Disney very, very troubling in the experience of being an American, in the experience of America in the world, in this fantastical, in the delusional, in what you call the triumph of the American imagination in some ways. Having spent 7 years in that mindset, shall we say, are you comfortable with that? I mean, you already, when you look at entertainment, are suggesting we might have some questions to ask about this entertainment motif. Were those questions enhanced for you by thinking your way through Disney, who is the archetypal American?
Yes, they were. You know, my last book before the Disney book was called Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality. And as I said earlier, I mean, it is a book in which I deal with what I regard as the major cultural transformation of the 20th century, which is the conversion of life itself into an entertainment medium.
And you do have an opinion about the quantity as well as quality.
Yes, I do. I mean, although that book is more diagnostic than prescriptive, as most of my work is, frankly. I mean, I'm not there to tell people how they ought to live their lives. What I'm there to do is to examine the American scene and to try and understand it.
Because like a fish in water, we don't really see it until somebody like you tells us what
we're in
the middle of.
We don't understand. Exactly. I mean, that's how I feel. We don't understand the forces that surround us on a daily basis and that change our lives. And in writing Life the Movie, I can't tell you how many letters I got from people who said, you know, I never realized that indeed my life was essentially a movie and that I was performing a role within my life. And that I was looking for certain narrative, plot points within my life, certain things to fulfill, and how much of my life was surrounded by the props, the car I drove, the house I lived in, the place I sent my children to school. All of those things were part of a larger narrative that I was creating for my life.
Whether
I wanted to or not, but I almost felt compelled to do so. And in that book, I do talk about the advantages of doing so and about the disadvantages of doing so. Now, this is sort of the same approach, I think, that many people have had to Walt Disney. And in Walt Disney, in my book on Walt Disney, you know, I try and be very even-handed. You know, I try not to condemn Walt Disney or to praise Walt Disney, but to lay out a kind of analysis of Walt Disney and the whole notion of Disneyfication. On the positive side, there are people who believe that, you know, Walt Disney showed us a way to control our lives. That Disneyfication, which is often used derogatorily as faux experience, that, you know, Disney nevertheless said, look it, you know, I know what real experiences are, but sometimes we need a release from real experience, and faux experience is a way of doing that. And as I've argued in other contexts, you know, for those who criticize Disneyland, for example, for not confronting reality, you know, I've said, well, wait a minute now. I don't know that that's a charge that is fair against Walt Disney, because, you know, what do you want to do? Go into Walt Disney, go into Disneyland and find Holocaust land, slavery land? If you want reality, believe me, there's plenty of it outside Disneyland. You don't have to pay the money to go inside Disneyland to find it. And Walt understood that. Walt understood that that berm that surrounds Disneyland was a physical barrier and a metaphoric barrier between a fantasy world and a real world. On the other hand, if that becomes part of your mental equipment, the whole notion of Disneyfication, if you look at the world through that prism, where you believe that everything can be converted into a fantasy because our will is strong enough now. As Daniel Boorstin once said, we are the first generation, he wrote this in 1961, who can live within its own illusions. If you really believe that, there is a tremendous danger in that.
And we're seeing much of that manifest.
Of course. I mean, if you think that the world will simply respond to your will, you are a fool, ultimately.
Well, if you think the world's a Western.
Yes.
Which is essentially, it's not just Disney. I mean,
right.
Hollywood.
But Disney symbolizes a certain kind, which is why he's become the target of so many cultural critics, because he symbolizes a certain habit of mind.
And yet you say, look again. There's another way of thinking about Disney as well.
Part of the reason, though, I think, is those same critics also object to the reactionary he became, the political reactionary. And I think that
they thought he became,
right. Yes. That affected their critique of Disney and their attitude, and really, in many ways, our now perspective on Disney.
Well, several things affected that critique. One thing is that when Walt Disney came to prominence in the 1930s, he was accepted by intellectuals as an artistic naif. Oh, they love this young, and he was young. Remember, when he creates Mickey Mouse, he's 26 years old. He releases Snow White when he's 36 years old. So he's a very young man when he rises to prominence. But they love the idea of this uneducated, as we talked about earlier, young artistic naif without any pretensions.
It's folk art.
Exactly. That's what they thought of Walt Disney as, a folk artist.
At a high level.
At a very high level. But even if he wasn't at a high level, the fact was there was a certain condescension, Paula, in that view of Walt Disney. And what they recognized when he made Fantasia and Walt showed his hand is that he wasn't unpretentious. He had tremendous pretensions. Walt Disney saw himself as an artist. And Fantasia, in my estimation, is the beginning of the end of Walt's critical reputation. Now, as you point out, Bill, that critical reputation, or the decline of that critical reputation, gains enormous momentum after the war, when he testifies before HUAC as a friendly witness.
HUAC being the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yes, which is investigating Hollywood in 1947. And Walt comes and testifies as a friendly witness to talk about communist influence within the industry. And then Walt Disney is fingered as a reactionary. And that, as I say, only accelerates the momentum of his critical decline. So when you put together the idea that Walt is degrading popular culture with the fact that he is a reactionary politically, or at least perceived to be so, this is a double whammy against Walt Disney. Now, in point of fact, as I point out in the book, Walt Disney was largely apolitical. He had no interest in politics except after the strike. And after the strike, he believes that the studio was struck because there were communist elements in the Screen Cartoonists Guild, the union that was seeking recognition. And Walt believed that those communists were targeting Walt Disney. They were going to bring down Walt Disney. And he is vehemently anti-communist after that. He voted for Franklin Roosevelt in 1936, but after 1941, he is a hidebound Republican who is fighting communism.
Well, and there were communists. In the union.
There were communists in the union, as I point out in the book. Walt Disney wasn't entirely wrong. He didn't react to it, in my estimation, in a very productive way, but he was right in his analysis.
But he was wrong in the part that he played in this country becoming fearful.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, Paula, because there is a recent reinterpretation of Walt Disney, which I find very persuasive and very interesting, and I cite it in the book by a University of Texas professor by the name of Douglas Brody. And the book is called From Walt to Woodstock. And here's Brody's argument. His argument is that Walt Disney, far from being a reactionary in his films, regardless of what he was in his own personal life, and he was a Republican and he did contribute to Barry Goldwater and all of that, in his films, Walt was actually a promoter of tolerance, anti-authoritarianism, hatred of money, hatred of hypocrisy. All the things that we regard as liberal values were pervaded by Walt Disney's movies. And as I point out in the book, if you take a film as pathetic as Pollyanna, what is Pollyanna, which is actually a pretty good movie, what is Pollyanna really about? Pollyanna, this little girl who, through her goodness, converts this community, shames the hypocrites in her community, shames the religious authorities in the community for being hypocrites. It is a liberal movie from a very illiberal human being.
Well, and if you think about it, I don't, you're a little younger than we are, but Fantasia played a role at a certain time in the 60s that, I mean, I know a lot of people who would use the available chemicals and go... and go off to the theaters that had rediscovered Fantasia. Again, this goes to the, you know, the, it ain't simple. Our, you know, the idea
right.
that there is a Walt Disney. And there's a double twist in that because in some ways that simplicity appears to be what Walt Disney did, which is to simplify the faux reality as opposed to the real.
And he fed that, Bill. I mean, let's face it. At a point when he is turned on by the intellectuals, Walt Disney himself, as a defense mechanism, becomes somewhat anti-intellectual. So now Walt Disney is in the position of defending himself against his critics by saying, yeah, I'm simple, and so what? What are you going to do about it?
This is Neil Gabler, who just did what Walt Disney does and took on the character. We'll all be back in just a moment. We trust you'll be with us for a few more minutes with Neil Gabler here on The Paula Gordon Show. A couple more minutes here on The Paula Gordon Show with Neil Gabler, talking about Walt Disney because it is such an important subject in the world at large. Bill Russell, you may want to introduce this part of the conversation.
You know, the Platonic, the notion that ideal is static, and Disney is a screaming example of a constantly shifting sense of what is, you know, what matters and what is perfect and what is perfectible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only way you can get even close to a resolution is follow him to the end of his life and look at where he landed. Not necessarily, you know, if he'd been immortal, he'd still be off wandering some other place, but he wasn't. And he hit, you know, the last great frontier for him was
Epcot. You know, I mean, if you look at Walt Disney's career, first he begins by creating, you know, perfect worlds on the screen with his animations. Then he brings those perfect worlds, when he feels the animations have gone as far as they can possibly go, into the real world by creating Disneyland. But nevertheless, as we said earlier, there's a barrier between Disneyland and the real world. Walt sees his legacy, and he does think of the legacy commensurate with Walt Disney. He thinks of himself in those terms as bringing Disneyland into the real world, by which I mean tearing down the berm and converging or merging Disneyland with the real world. And that is Epcot, his experimental, prototypical community of tomorrow.
But
which
that's not what we think of as Epcot.
No. Epcot now is a glorified World's Fair. Walt Disney's Epcot was a fully operational city of the future, no cars, monorails and people movers, no waste removal except underground. It was designed with concentric circles, with a downtown area and then a recreational area and then a band of schools and churches and then a residential area and then another recreational area.
Sounds pretty good.
Well, it sounded great. However, there was one problem. The flaw in the system is, I mean, Walt was somewhat Mussolini-esque in designing this Epcot. The problem is that we live in a democracy. And he envisioned that 100,000 people were going to live in his experimental city, but Walt didn't want them to have any real rights over their lives. He wanted to control their lives. And I write in the book about the torturous way in which Walt tried to reconcile his command of Epcot with the democratic imperatives of America. It wasn't easy. And of course, Epcot was not built in Walt Disney's lifetime. In fact, at the end of his life, after he's dead, one of his collaborators goes to Roy, Walt's brother, and says, we've really got to build Epcot as a memorial to Walt. This is what everything was headed toward in Walt's life. And Roy said, Walt's dead.
Whoa.
And so was Epcot.
And in closing, there is a sense that Walt never quite lost some of the beauty of the young Walt.
Interesting thing about Walt Disney, a case of arrested development, and that's often said about individuals, but Walt Disney really, because of Roy Disney, was able to live within his imagination in a way that almost no one else in American business is able to do.
In American business?
Yes.
Well, we'll have to continue this conversation because there's so much more to be said, and we'll read the rest of the book so as to be able to do that when you return the next time. Neil Gabriel,
I look forward to that.
We thank Neil Gabler for Walt Disney and for caring so much about what America creates and shares with the world. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well. Thank you.